From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn how two recent decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court could impact the power of the executive branch. Then we're joined by two Black women of trans experience to discuss the many inequities transgender people still face.
Whether we know each other or not, whether we will call each other friends or not, we are really all a family, and we all have grown up with each other and been a part of and seen different parts of each other's journeys. And a lot of that includes times when Black trans women are not safe.
Plus, we learn about a coronavirus children's book that was inspired by a writing competition.
I was hoping to create a realistic situation about what a family may be dealing with, but yet really trying to have fun with it as well.
Like Effect is next, but first the news. This is Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Late last week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court announced its decisions on key cases concerning the power of the state's executive branch. The rulings effectively limit the power of Wisconsin's Attorney General and overruled several of Governor Tony Evers' vetoes from the 2019 state budget. Paul Nolet is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to unpack the significance of these decisions.
So there have been a couple big rulings from the Supreme Court that I'd like to go through. First, let's look at the lame duck laws passed by the Wisconsin legislature. Can you give us a refresher on that situation?
Yeah, so right after the 2018 elections in which Democrats had really a statewide sweep of elected offices, including the governor, Tony Evers, and the attorney general, Josh Call, much like in, you know, on the national level and here in Wisconsin, there's a lame duck period in which after the election, the old guard, the previous governor and the previous legislature, still have powers to enact legislation, sign legislation into law before the new governor, attorney general, et cetera, are sworn into office. And so that period, that lame duck period, Republicans in the legislature, when Governor Scott Walker was still governor, enacted a series of legislation that cut back on the powers of both the governor and the attorney general. And that was, of course, prospective, looking at the Democrats that were coming into office that following year, so at the very beginning of 2019. And among other things, and specifically the ones that were at issue in this litigation that the Supreme Court just decided, one of the biggest ones was really limiting the power of Josh Call, the attorney general, and how he conducts his business. So among other things, the legislation allowed the legislature to enter into litigation if the attorney general office decides we don't want to participate. So then the legislature can hire their own attorneys and get involved in a case. And also one of the most contentious and controversial ones was requiring Call to get approval from the legislature and a legislative committee anytime that they settle any lawsuit. So the AG's office frequently sues corporations, companies for consumer fraud and environmental violations and that sort of thing. This required the AG's office to get permission from the legislature to go ahead with any settlement.
Yeah, what was the rationale for really forcing the attorney general to get each of these settlements passed through the legislature?
I think the big thing was getting more control over the priorities that the AG office wanted to pursue. Because one thing that we've seen here in Wisconsin and then all across the country is, first of all, state AG offices becoming much more powerful, getting involved in more and more things. Right now, there's still that ongoing massive opioid investigation that all the AGs across the country are involved in, for instance. And I think the legislature sees the AG office as being increasingly powerful, and they wanted some control over what the AG could do, especially since, much like the governor's office, it shifted from Republican to Democrat, and Josh Call identified additional priorities that may not have been as big of a priority in the previous AG administration, like going after environmental violators, for instance. And so the legislature passed this to try to get more control over just exactly what the AG office can do.
How does that impact what the Attorney General is able to do in his position?
Yeah, I think it's a lot. And going back to that first change that I mentioned, which allows the legislature to hire their own attorneys if they don't like where the AG office is going, I think, you know, Josh Call didn't like that one either. The AG's office didn't like that one, making the claim that it should be the AG representing the state litigation. But it's probably something that they can live with, because after all, it's not necessarily interfering directly with their conduct in office, the AG's ability to litigate. But this settlement piece, I think, was really the biggest one, because that really deeply impacts the way that the AG office operates. I mean, typically, settlements can take months. I mean, look at the opioid litigation. That litigation's been going on for some time, and that those investigations, and yet there's still not a overall settlement. These things take a lot of time and a lot of careful negotiation with the defendants, the corporate defendants. Introducing the legislature and putting another barrier to settlement there is something that the AG's office has argued is going to fundamentally change what they do and how they can actually conduct themselves in office and in some of the most important work that they do, which is going after, again, environmental violators, consumer fraudsters, and that sort of thing.
You know, going back to that first piece that the legislature is allowed to hire outside lawyers, as a taxpayer, we're paying the Attorney General to head up these lawsuits. This piece of the puzzle here has pretty clear potential of costing taxpayers a lot of money. When it went to the Supreme Court, what did the justices say about that provision? Are there any caps there? Is there anything that regulates how much money they can spend on these lawyers? Or could they be spending millions of dollars more to hire these outside lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, potentially they could be. They could be spending a lot of money on this litigation. Really, the thrust of the opinion when it came to the AG's powers really had to do with, to what extent is the Attorney General an executive office that, by the use of separation of powers in the Wisconsin Constitution, is really separate and untouchable by the legislature. And essentially, the justices said the AG is this sort of quasi-executive, quasi-legislative almost officer that, when they settle cases and bring litigation, they're getting involved in areas that the legislature also has a real interest in, you know, with the power of the purse, for instance, bringing in money from corporate violators. So they essentially said the legislature has enough reason why they might want to hire their own attorneys. And like you said, that might end up being a big cost, and a cost that duplicates as you have the AG office with one set of litigation and then the legislature also hiring attorneys and imposing that cost on taxpayers. So that is a concern. One other concern that comes out of this is, what happens when the legislature wants to hire its own attorneys because it doesn't like what the AG office is doing, and they're essentially competing with one another, and they're both claiming that they're doing what they're doing in litigation on behalf of the state of Wisconsin? And that's where you start getting into really difficult situations about who actually is representing the state in litigation. And I will say that, just looking at the big picture and comparing this to other states too, is that this is something that has picked up steam, this sort of AG legislative or AG governor conflict has really emerged in the last 5-6 years as a point of contention in a number of states, where you have these officials claiming that they are the ones who should be representing the state in litigation. The settlements piece the second part is really something new. I mean, no other state has something like this. So the court upholding it really creates a situation for the Wisconsin AG that no other AG in the country is really dealing with right now.
Well, and it seems like the people of Wisconsin voted for the attorney general to represent them in these lawsuits. And I think this gets to a big question about all the lame duck laws, that it was in some ways trying to nullify the results of the election, which the Republican-led legislature was not shy about saying they didn't like. They didn't like that Governor Evers was now going to be the governor. They didn't like that the new AG would be a Democrat. When we look at the dissenting opinions in this case, why didn't they vote to uphold these laws?
Yeah, it goes back to that dispute over separation of powers and exactly what sort of powers each official, whether you're talking about legislative officials or those in the executive branch, what sort of powers they should have. And so the dissenters on the AG pieces are essentially saying the legislature makes laws, right? And the executive branch is supposed to execute the law. And that includes the AG executing the laws that the legislature makes. But the dissenters essentially are saying here, the legislature wants the power to both make the laws and then to essentially enforce the laws, or to tell the AG how they're going to enforce the laws that are on the books. And that, according to the governor and the AG, as well as the dissenters in the opinion, violates separation of powers. It goes too far. It's the legislature exceeding its authority under the Wisconsin Constitution. On the other hand, the argument against this and the argument that won the day in the Supreme Court was that the AG, by engaging in this litigation, by settling these cases with corporate defendants, is getting involved in an area that directly implicates legislative power. And so therefore, the legislature should have some say over things like the power of the purse, which is involved in whenever the AG settles a multi-million dollar case, let's say, with a corporate defendant. So that's really the crux of the debate, is about the nature of separation of powers in the Wisconsin Constitution.
Yeah. Moving on to the next ruling by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which seemed to scale back Governor Evers' veto power. Again, could you give us a refresher on this situation?
Yeah, so one going back actually quite a few years, well before Governor Evers, it's been clear that the Wisconsin governor has one of the strongest veto powers of any governor in the country. And part of the reason is because, like a lot of governors elsewhere, the Wisconsin governor has what's known as a line item veto. So essentially doesn't have to make the decision like the president of the United States does to either completely veto a bill or not, but instead has the power to veto particular lines out of a bill, so parts of a bill. The thing that makes the Wisconsin governor even more powerful when it comes to the veto power is that the governor has been able to veto not only lines or like pages out of a bill, but individual words and even numbers from bills. And there have been in the last, I mean, this is going back 20, 30 years, there have been efforts, and some of which have been successful, to amend the Wisconsin Constitution to limit the governor's veto power in ways where, you know, let's say that the legislature appropriates $20 million to something. It used to be the case that the governor could just scratch out the zero and then make it $2 million. And so that was seen as kind of maybe an abuse of power, and voters voted to change the Constitution to stop that. But nevertheless, the governor has a good deal of power to alter words or to cross words out that are in a bill that the governor is signing in a way that could really change the policy. And so what the legislature did here was try to limit the governor's power further, to essentially say you can't use a veto in a way that fundamentally changes what the legislature was trying to do. And that argument really won the day with these lawsuits that were challenging to block these vetoes from Governor Evers. And I should mention these vetoes had to do with essentially money going to vehicle charging stations. It had to do with vaping, transportation funding, fees on trucks. So kind of like a lot of nuts and bolts type of stuff that the state does. But the legislature claimed that the governor was essentially changing the whole purpose of what the bill was about and what these particular items were appropriated for.
So how is this going to impact the governor's veto power moving forward?
It's a great question, and one that really wasn't answered fully by this decision today, because it was actually kind of an odd decision in many ways, because it was split on all these different types of vetoes. Largely, it was, you could probably characterize the decision as a 5-2 vote, with the 5 conservatives joining together and the 2 liberals dissenting. There was a 4-3 vote on one of them on the vaping piece. But one thing that was interesting here is that even though the conservatives largely banded together to strike down Governor Evers' vetoes, they didn't have a coherent reasoning. They didn't agree on the reasoning amongst themselves about why these are struck down. And so it's actually not all that clear moving forward what the governor's powers are when it comes to vetoes, just that it looks like there are going to be additional limitations whenever the governor tries to strike out individual words from a legislative proposal that's on his desk in a way that fundamentally changes what the legislature was trying to do. But this was actually something that the dissenters picked up on and said, at this time, we need some clarity about what the governor's veto power is, and the majority didn't give it to us today.
You know, we're talking about all of these cases, and we're still, you know, looking at 5-2 decisions a lot of the time. I think something that's very confusing for voters is the fact that despite losing back in April, Justice Dan Kelly is still ruling on cases 3 months later. Why is that?
Yeah, and it's because those elections, it's almost kind of similar to the lame duck period that legislators have and the governor has, where there's a approximately 2 or 3 month period between the old guard and the new guard coming in. Much in the same way, the Supreme Court's term runs through July and August. So they're still deciding cases. They're at the end of the line in terms of deciding cases for this term, but that continues until the summer when the new justices are sworn in. So you have this situation where even a justice who's lost a re-election bid is still deciding cases for that term before the new justice is sworn in. So would that have changed things? Possibly, although a lot of these decisions were 5-2, which is the conservative majority currently on the Supreme Court, and that's going to shrink down to 4-3, essentially 4 mostly conservative, 3 mostly liberal justices on the Supreme Court. So overall, I don't think a whole lot would have changed with the new justice coming in, but it is an interesting feature of how the Supreme Court works that there is this rather lengthy lame duck period where the defeated justice is still deciding on cases.
Paul Nolette is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Fex Joy Powers. Coming up next, we have a discussion with 2 local Black women of trans experience. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Although Black transgender people have been involved in racial and LGBTQ justice movements from their inceptions, they have not been prioritized. We're starting to see not just more trans visibility, but elevation, particularly within the Black Lives Matter movement. However, this is in stark contrast to disproportionate rates of violence that trans women of color face. There have already been 21 transgender homicides reported in 2020. In addition to violence, transgender people also face higher rates of unemployment, poverty, and homelessness. To get a firsthand perspective on the challenges facing Black women of trans experience, I'm joined by Elle Halo, a community activist and LGBTQ health equity advocate, and Naomi Antral-Jones, a PrEP services coordinator at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Jones starts by sharing the challenges of being trans and Black in the state of Wisconsin.
It's extremely difficult just being a person of trans experience in Wisconsin, then to throw on top of Black in the climate that we're in. What led me to this type of work was just seeing that there was no spaces for trans women. And then there were like a lot of, oh, whenever there's something big and they want someone to speak, then they invite the trans woman, but there's never no spaces where we get the same response and the same safety and the same care as anyone else in the community. There's been several times just being out in the community and sexually assaulted and you know things like that. And that's on a normal basis and no one cares because we're trans. And that happens on such a regular basis. And it led me to like this work because I felt like we got to talk about it because we are human. We're not just some sexual objects that are should be objectified and you know, just and mocked.
As young Black trans women in Milwaukee, there are internal community politics. There are things that continue to ostracize us even within the Black queer community. And we are judged and examined just quite frankly in ways that cis people and that other queer identities don't have to deal with, even other trans people. And in many ways our experiences with other trans people and non-binary people are the same. We are disproportionately affected by sexual harassment and assault. I like to particularly identify that we get stalked and cyber-stalked on a regular basis, and those things produce confusion and anxiety and paranoia, and we're solicited regardless of the existence of consensual sex work or not. We're solicited and harassed and hounded and even left to believe in our socialization just as Americans and with our current mainstream culture that sex work or fashion or drag or retail are the only ways in which trans women can find employment or can find gainful employment. And we need to decriminalize sex work for the benefit particularly of Black trans women and of trans women. And to do that in a way that centers trans women. I think in Milwaukee, I think we're in a unique place in a lot of different ways because of our size, the size of our city. I think it makes it possible for us to connect in ways that aren't possible in bigger cities. And like all the girls, like we know each other. And you know what I mean? In the whole Black queer community here in Milwaukee, at like, you know what I mean? At a certain point, we've all grown up with each other, whether we know each other or not, whether we will call each other friends or not, we are really all a family. And we all have grown up with each other and been a part of and seen different parts of each other's journeys. And a lot of that includes times when Black trans women are not safe, have not been safe in public, are being outed, are being harassed, are being followed. A lot of times that's people trying to fight with us or engage us in violence or sex work or drugs. And in the resocialization that happens when you transition, you know, there are no guidebooks that really tell you how it is and how it is to be a young woman and transition in your own life. But like Naomi said, transition in America in the ways that everyone sees us.
Al, you mentioned some of the unique qualities of Milwaukee. Naomi, do you agree with that? And in your opinion, is Milwaukee similar, better, or worse place to live as a Black woman of trans experience compared to other cities? Or is this a reflection of the country as a whole when it comes to how it views trans people?
Just overall, Wisconsin's not the best place for people of color. It's been voted the most racist city, state for a couple years now. But as for a Black trans woman, the community, like we can literally count on one hand of who's who, when things happen, there's not enough of us. So it becomes kind of competitive of who's who, who's that. And we start to take digs at each other and things like that. So I do agree, like, in bigger cities like Chicago and things like that, they don't have as many issues like we do because they're not as close together.
One thing, Elle, you touched upon is the deep history of homophobia and issues within the queer community when it comes to how it views trans people as well. And with this unique time of the BLM movement converging with Pride, and for the first time in quite some time that Black trans lives are at the forefront, are looking to be included in this movement. But the Black community has a deep history of homophobia, and the LGBTQ community is, of course, a place where racism also exists. And then you add transphobia on top of all this. So I'm curious about your thoughts and reactions of seeing the Black community finally and widely come together and acknowledge that Black trans lives matter, and that you need to be included in the movement, not just as participants, but at the forefront as leaders.
I think it's important that we be centered in the Black Lives Matter movement. One, because that's the true vision of the movement. Black Lives Matter was created by three women of color and by two queer women of color. And all of our movements that have produced actual change were intergenerational, they were intersectional, and people called on different people's voices to be able to lend to the movement and to be able to activate and mobilize different communities. And we have to do that again. I don't see it as like a political woke thing, you know, it's a necessity to include us. It's a necessity to vocally acknowledge and to have representation from queer communities at this time. And I also think that just as a nation and as Black people in this nation, that we're seeing that this is the time that we all have to have our voices heard. This is the time that we all have to demand justice for everything from police brutality and incarceration to our health disparities, to our safety issues. And even just in the last week, there were two trans women killed, and one of them was 17 or 18 years old, Brayla. And our life expectancy is 35 years old. That's less than the Black man, and that's less than the Black queer man, regardless of the fact that we're all facing systemic oppression and facing different things that are direct attacks on our bodies and direct attacks on our health and safety.
Yeah, Naomi, your thoughts on the two movements converging?
Honestly, I just feel like it's about time because trans women didn't just start getting killed and slaughtered. It just got publicized. And I feel that where we are now, we have nothing to lose, so we're demanding respect. You're going to either include us or you're going to include us.
Or you're going to lose your job.
Exactly. Like, we're not, I feel like we've gotten smarter on how we have to play the game. We used to, you know, try to do uproars and things like that, but now we're going to beat you at your own game. And they had to, and I feel like we have to be included because we're part of the Black community. The Black community should not be subjective of, oh, we don't include you because you're this. No, if you're Black, you're Black. And if we're going to take the thoughts of we are trying to stop police brutality for Black people, we got to include all Black people. So, yeah, I just feel like we are demanding the respect that we deserved for years. We're no longer hiding in the shadows. We're no longer going to be someone's secret. We're no longer, we have a new plethora of what trans women are. We're not what the media have shown us as just sex workers. Now we're career women, and we are able to get the respect that we're deserving. And we needed to be a part of this movement because we've been dying at an alarming rate that they haven't paid attention to and they haven't cared about. But trans women, last year, there was 26 trans women who died. That didn't just start, it just was never talked about.
Can I add to that, Naomi? All of our issues are like that. Black maternal morbidity in Milwaukee is like that. They knew that Wisconsin was experiencing higher rates of Black maternal morbidity 15 years ago, and they stopped collecting data in response to it so that it wouldn't reflect bad on the state. Now we have the worst in the nation. 15 years ago, that wasn't the worst in the nation. 15 years ago was the time to have been actionable on that, and they chose not to do that. We've known about youth homelessness, LGBTQ youth homelessness and suicide for 40, 50 years. We've known about Black trans women being killed in this country for 30, 40, 50 years. And I think that what we're seeing with Black trans women being killed in this country is directly related to, is a legacy that begins with other women of the era that were killed, but particularly of the way in which Marsha P. Johnson was killed and how that case remains unsolved. I think it informs why there is even no effort of justice on the behalf of Black trans women, why we're misgendered and deadnamed once we've passed on, and why people allow themselves and their privilege to assume that everything is just because of sex work or because of drugs or because of things that are myths about the lifestyles and the real lives and livelihoods of trans women. When one of the cases from last year that just resonates just so much within me, and I think also resonates with the killing that I just mentioned of Brella Jones. And so Claire Legato, I spoke about this at the March with Pride and at our T-Door event. Claire Legato was a young girl in DC. She was 16. And this was last year, and she was killed by her mother's boyfriend over tax money after, like, her mother and the boyfriend got into an altercation about tax money, and Claire got into the middle of it. And while the mainstream would peg that as just another trans murder and allow people to think whatever they would think about that, but this is a young girl. She's 16. She wasn't, like, in a human trafficking setting, there's almost only so much she could have been doing, period. And this is a family member that killed her, which is very common in all domestic violence, is for the killer to not be a stranger and not be someone that's just harassing us on the street or a mob or some type of violence that you couldn't have escaped, but that is happening in our homes. And that is our families, and that is our partners, just like any other type of woman. And I think we have to just be more cognizant of that, and more accountable to the fact that we have real light bulbs. We've not been seeing HIV statistics for 30, 40 years while Black communities are getting sicker and while white communities are getting healthier. We've not seen, even in terms of data collection and the different things that we're seeing with COVID-19, like, all of these things are repeated patterns that are delved out by institutions for little people to deal with. But instead of attacking the systems, we are attacked. And we're at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of the oppression Olympics, in terms of people paying attention to our issues and caring or doing anything about them, even when they're seeing it with their own eyes. And that we're just silenced, and that we're just not even really able to conceptualize sometimes healthy lifestyle and healthy relationships or what safety looks like in a healthy way.
Right. And you note the intersection of health and healthcare, and both of you are involved in healthcare. Elle, you're a health navigator. Naomi, you work with children. So can you expand a bit more on why advocacy in healthcare is so important?
For me, it goes back to just the medical mistrust. And we're at a point where we need access to doctors, and we are so far gone. Like, I have a father who is he's in his 50s and will go to the doctor at the last minute. And I realized something. That is something that we are taught, and it's been passed down. We were always taught to not go to the doctor, take care of it at home, especially like dealing with insurance. And a lot of times when we go to the doctor, the jargon that is used, the language that they're using and things like that is confusing to us. They might diagnose us with something, but not tell us really what that is and how that works. So I came into this knowing that and understanding that I wanted to teach people not just that they should go to the doctor, but how to navigate systems like healthcare, how to advocate for themselves and say, like, I don't understand what you're saying. Can you break that down for me? Or can you get somebody else to come break it down for me? And letting them know that at the end of the day, you are a customer going here. You should be satisfied and you should be taken care of. And if you feel like you're not getting the right level of care, you need to advocate for that and understand that you can advocate for that. And that's one big thing that I wanted to do within my role is just teach people, even if you don't get prep services and things like that, that you should know how to navigate and go to the doctor to be preventative and not reactive.
I appreciate this question. I personally am a writer, and so I've grown up in my Black family reading and disseminating information for adults. And even now, people look to me to be able to explain processes, to be able to explain policy, to be able to explain healthcare disparities and different things, like even down to what's in the news. And a lot of that is directly related to the ways in which institutions are based in colonialism, period, and the way that American literacy is a concept and is not like an actual skill. You get what I'm saying? Like the average American doesn't, you know what I mean, use language correctly, nor, I mean, effectively understand it correctly. So that's not like unique to Black people, but Black people's expectation of being able to process data and collected data that's collected through a frame of colonialism is all a part of that. And just our literacy as communities is just all a part of that. But particularly my mom is an evangelist, and she had a long, long, long journey my whole youth where I was essentially a caretaker to her, of having to self-advocate before we had the language of medical mistrust and before we had the language and the identity of the issue being that Black women are believed by their doctors on a regular basis. Myself, coming into leadership roles is all rooted in me coming into my transition and into adulthood and navigating those things as a community member and then being invited into leadership. And so I think that it's important to have people that don't just understand things from an academic perspective or from a data-based perspective. And I think it's most important to have people that are providing services to look like the people that they're providing them to. And I think that that has to be actionable and not just a concept, and that it's possible. It's possible for the Diverse and Resilient Board to be over 60% African-American. It's possible for the staff there to be over 80% African-American because that's the population that they're serving. And, you know, countless of other models of, you know what I mean, companies that are doing that and that are making that a part of their structure. But I think my self-advocacy journey informs my work. And I think that my mom's self-advocacy journey taught me that early on and taught me, you know, that there is an attack on the Black anatomy and the Black body in terms of our healthcare system and in terms, obviously, of our safety issues as a whole community. And that we do have to form our own awareness around that, and that we do still have to get services and still have to educate ourselves, regardless of it being inside of a system that's also harmful to us.
Mm-hmm. How do you both think that leaders can be better developed within the community, either when it comes to healthcare, local businesses, the overall equity? I mean, we are seeing people are certainly starting to be more engaged in activism with the marches worldwide, but the work needs to be continued beyond when people march, right? So how do you think people can better be elevated to that platform?
One thing I always tell people, if you are able to offer an opportunity to do it, so you can march with me right now and all that's great, but if a trans girl comes to your job and apply and she's qualified, give her the chance of getting that job. For me, my own personal journey, I held off my transition a very long time. What I think was a very long time, just so I could finish school, just so I can get set in my career. And I felt like I would be safe in my career. I knew that transitioning is expensive. And although I support my sisters who are able, or not just able, but are in that fight that they have to do sex work, I just didn't want to see that for myself. So I made sure that I made sure I went to school. I made sure that I did these things, and I held off being who I truly was, which hurt me because I didn't. I just knew what I needed for my life. And we have to make those type of sacrifices being trans people.
Thank you, Naomi. I appreciate you sharing that. Just myself. And I want to tell you, like, you know, there is no right time. There is no perfect time. And it happens. We're adults. We are young women. We're adults. You know what I mean? We're not supposed to be how we were when we were younger. We're supposed to grow, and that's what happened. And everything in people's transition all happens in the right time for them. And that is something, and the loss and the disconnection and the exclusion and just the anxiety and the amount of emotional distress that all of those things compound into is effectively years lost out of our lives in terms of where we would want to be. And it's frustrating as, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's frustrating as hell, you know? Like, in terms of being involved in community leadership, like, I've always known that for myself. I've always known that I would be an educator. And for that to be put off for, you know what I mean, years at a time, like, that's hurtful, and that's something that we have to process while still doing the work.
Elle Halo and Naomi Antrell Jones are two local Black women of trans experience. Halo is a community activist, LGBTQ health equity advocate, and board member of Diverse and Resilient, among her many other titles. Antrell Jones is a prep services coordinator for the youth at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. There's lots more to our conversation, and you can listen to all of it at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then return with children's book author Laura Heiler. Like Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On April 14th, the Emory Global Health Institute launched a contest for authors to write a children's book to explain COVID-19. The catch? Well, they only had about a couple weeks to do it. Wisconsin children's book author Laura Heiler was working on a different project when she heard about the contest, but decided to turn a story around in just 10 days. Our bodies stay home, our imagination runs free, follows 7-year-old Maya as she navigates life during the coronavirus pandemic. The book is intended to help children understand how they can cope, help, and find joy in this new normal. Heiler joins me now and starts by explaining what inspired her to take on this project.
So I, like everyone else, really struggling with the changes to my life caused by coronavirus. And then, of course, as a children's book author, started thinking about how children must be impacted by this when suddenly they didn't have, you know, classroom setting, they didn't have play dates, they didn't have time with their extended family members. So I became aware of a challenge created by the Emory Global Health Institute out of Atlanta. And they were encouraging authors to write a book that would help children cope. And there was a 2-week period for us to write our books.
And what did you initially think of that challenge? Was it a welcome challenge or somewhat intimidating?
Well, I have a traditional publisher and I have a 3-book contract for a middle grade series. The first book debuted in March of 2018 called The Stupendous Adventures of Mighty Marty Hayes. I was in the middle of writing book 2. When I became aware of the Emory Global Health Institute challenge and basically said, wow, I don't have time to do this. And then there were about 10 days remaining in the challenge when I decided to jump in. So I contacted my publisher, I contacted my illustrator who is based in Barbados, and we all decided to go for it. So the challenge was undertaken.
So tell us why you wanted to center this story around Maya and her family. Did this character and her world come pretty quickly and naturally to you?
It came pretty quickly. I was definitely paying attention to the changes in my neighborhood. I live in a beautiful wooded subdivision in Glendale, Wisconsin, and was listening to how the children around me were coping. So lots of different ages, and I could still hear lots of laughter. And then I would have chats with some of the older kids, middle school, high school, and they were really talking about some of the challenges with the online studying and not seeing an end in sight. They didn't know when they would get back into the classroom. So I decided to create a story of fiction, but still adhering to the safety measures that we were all following, are still all following. And I came up with 7-year-old Maya, her 10-year-old brother Brian. The parents are working from home, and then they're separated physically from the grandparents, but they are very much still part of their lives, and they're dealing with them, talking to them via video chat. So I was hoping to create a realistic situation about what a family may be dealing with, but yet really trying to have fun with it as well.
Just as you mentioned, those images of living at home constantly surrounded by your family of all ages, virtual learning and the struggles that come with that, to Maya still trying to have a meaningful birthday party coming up. Do you think these key images will be ingrained in our brains when people look back and ask, what was the coronavirus like?
Yeah, one thing that jumped out at me as I walked around my own neighborhood, as I talked to children, was, you know, and many of us have seen this, you take walks and you see the chalk art, and people are putting together very uplifting messages. So I sort of did a take on that, played with that a little bit, and came up with a unique take on it. But it was really much thinking in terms of the kind of advice that we would have gotten from Mr. Rogers at this time, and that would have been to look to the helpers. And in my mind, I was thinking the children are very much our helpers as we go through the pandemic, because they are still having a sense of play, a lot of ingenuity as far as how they're approaching it. And I really took a lot of comfort from, you know, hearing the children's laughter in my neighborhood, seeing them keeping their day going and still just kind of getting through it. And then, of course, with the warmer weather, they are getting even more creative in their play while still social distancing. And it's just a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah. And what message did you want to convey to young children dealing with the ups and downs of suddenly living a different lifestyle as we are adjusting to the pandemic?
What I think has been fearful for children has the sense that it's out of their control, right? So they hear about the pandemic, they see the impact that it has on their family. If their family is, you know, struggling to just maintain some sort of schedule when mom and dad are working from home, or one parent is working from home, and then the parents also need to assist with online schooling, the kids are hearing the stress in their parents' voices. They're sensing the frustration, and they're feeling like there's nothing they can do. But when they are taught the proper safety measures and they're taught that they are helping to eradicate the virus, that gives them a real sense of empowerment. And it also leads to them seeing an end in sight, knowing that a vaccine is coming, knowing that school will resume one day in person again, and really starting to flourish, I think, with some of the online opportunities that have been out there. I've shared resources on my website to really let kids know that there's a lot that they can do. They can still visit places around the world like zoos and listen to authors reading their books and do a lot of things that otherwise they probably would not have thought of getting fully engaged in when they were on their regular schedule. So the key has been to you know, really equip the kids with information so that they can flourish during this time.
You wanted to reach kids that are about anywhere from 6 to 10 years old with this book. And you were kind of touching upon kids' special outlook during this period. So, and to me, it kind of shows a resiliency, you know, so are we also highlighting the resiliency that kids can hold and that you could express through the character Maya?
Oh, very much so. I think, you know, we really have to listen to kids during this time, and we may be surprised what we hear, because the kids are really asking questions based on their age level, really figuring out what they can do. And then once they feel like their questions have been answered, they're ready to go. So one of the activities that I have going on in the book is I have Maya listening to what she and her brother need to do around the house. So they need to help with disinfecting, for example. And then she comes up with an idea that the family can make masks for the community and for the neighborhood. And it really gives kids a sense of, you know, we're all in this together and we can all make this situation better if we all pitch in. And so we very much have that going on. And you can imagine a 7-year-old, how she's viewing this. And but like I said, there's a lot of fun and laughter. She and her brother have a good time spending time together. They're on the various video chats with friends and family and coming up with creative things like, let's eat ice cream while we're talking to our grandparents. And then she is turning 8. So there's a bit of a surprise at the end of the book as to how the family decides to handle her birthday party. And so, you know, we're really just talking about, yes, kids are very resilient, and it's a matter of letting them really make some choices about how they're going to go through their day.
And not only make some choices, but acknowledging that it's okay to feel the ups and downs of this too.
Very much so. Yeah, I do deal with one or two meltdowns in the book. So a 7-year-old is going to have that. Sometimes a 10-year-old would have a meltdown as well. But it comes from a sense of frustration and they're feeling uncomfortable. And that's where that usually comes from. So again, there's a lot of reassurance that comes from both parents and her older brother. And I think that this book will be very relatable for kids who have felt some of the fear associated with coronavirus, but also seeing just tons of signs of hope throughout the book.
On that note of families, not just here in the greater Milwaukee area, but around the world, sitting down and sharing this story together, how do you hope your book will play a part in helping kids in the future understand this moment in history, but also kids and parents get together and know how each other's feeling or to work through this together?
Yeah, I think that I'm hearing comments from adults, certainly, about how they've had time for reflection and how they were able to find some real upsides associated with spending a lot more time around their immediate family. And so I think kids are probably experiencing that as well. So I think we're seeing that probably the stress level of the family has reduced over time, and the kids are seeing that there were some really positive outcomes. So yeah, I think they will walk away after reading this book feeling very uplifted and really taking some positive measures into their future lives as they experience the new normal.
Laura Heiler is an author from Milwaukee. Her recent coronavirus book for children, Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imagination Runs Free, is out now. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Like Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.